Welcome back to Dear Skylar, where I talk to all kinds of interesting people about topics I'm asked about as a transgender educator and activist, things like gender, sexuality, sports, race, mental health, and so many things in between and beyond. This is the 30th and final episode of season one of Dear Skylar. We've had such a great time putting out this first season of my podcast, and I'm so excited to figure out what we're going to do for season two. As I've been making this podcast, one of the primary things I've thought about is what does representation mean? We've got all of these different ways that we can represent ourselves, that we can put ourselves into the world and the public eye, and a podcast is one of those ways. Over my career, representation has been a centerpiece in the work that I do. It's one of the most common questions I get from reporters and the media. What does it mean to have good representation, Skylar? What does it feel like to represent your community? And of course, I don't think that any one person can represent their community, but this topic of representation is really important. And so I thought that this would be the perfect way to end the season. Today, we'll be addressing the following question. What is good representation? To discuss this, I spoke with Leo Shang. Leo, I'm very excited that you're here. We've been babbling and talking, you know, before we started the recording, but, you know, I feel like I've known you for a long time. I was trying to, like, before you came here, I was trying to think about when I first met you, and I actually can't remember, like, the first time I followed you or found you. Do you remember how we, like, first connected?
I mean, it was definitely Instagram.
Yeah, for
sure. I think, I joined Instagram 2012, 2013, but that wasn't like joining it for transition related like reasons. I joined it as a school project
because
my school was like, we want to show you how fast social media can spread something, and if you get in trouble on social media, everyone will know.
Wow, you had a social media literacy class.
Yes and no. It was just kind of like I went to this school that wanted to progress for like the business world and like I think, you know, corporate capital America.
Yep.
And so they were like, this is what happens. This, what you do now online will impact your ability to get a job.
So fear mongering.
Sure. But very gentle fear mongering. And so I joined Instagram then and I just kept it. My first photo was like a picture of my shoe. And then over the like first year of having it, it became a transition related page. And probably in that year, maybe after the first years, I think when we connected, I think there was like all these pages popping up for like trans people of color specifically,
and
men of color. And I don't remember who saw who first. I think I might have maybe started my medical transition a little bit before you, but barely.
I think I found you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have such a clear picture in my mind of your top surgery. And seeing that and then watching you go through your journey with your top surgery. So my assumption is that I found you first, but, in any case, we've been connected for a long time.
Yes.
And it feels like we've been connected basically since this like began. And I say, this isn't like our trans movement, if you will.
Sure.
To some degree.
Yeah.
And both of our public nature as well. So, I know a good amount about you, but the listeners might not. So I'm curious if you could do a quick, you know, intro with your name and pronouns, and then anything you want to share about what you do and who you are in the world.
So my name is Leo Shang. I use he, him pronouns. We met on Instagram, and that's kind of where online is where my career sort of in wobbly quotation marks around trans activism online began. I did have Instagram, and then I was also writing for Huffington Post Teen actually at the time. And one of my first articles was about the character of Cole on The Fosters. Which I'm sure we'll talk about later. You're like, became sort of immersed in like online young journalism in a way around trans and queer issues. And I was also doing work in my like real life and personal life around school policy and like facilitation and dialogue. And I went to U of M, graduated from undergrad there. I did a year of grad school there in a social work program. And then I dropped out to become an actor. And I've been in LA for the last almost 4 years, working on a show and kind of just like acclimating to LA in a pandemic, and kind of figuring out what that kind of work looks like when you pair it with activism and advocacy and the various identities I hold as a trans man, a queer trans man, Asian American trans man, adoptee, you know, and LA is kind of this really big, I don't want to say mixing pot because we still are our individual selves, but it is a lot more diverse than the town in, I think, Ipsy that I, Michigan that I grew up in called Ypsilanti. Mm. Not just racially, but I think socioeconomically, career-wise. Mm. And so it's been an interesting few years. But yeah, now I'm here and just kind of figuring it out still.
I love that. I think I wish more people would be able to, I don't know if humble themselves is the right word, but be able to just say, yeah, I'm still figuring it out. Like, I feel like I'm like constantly figuring it out. Even like we're here, we're in an Airbnb with a bunch of cords everywhere that I've set up to make sure we can have hopefully the best sound experience right with this podcast. Mm-hmm. But I'm still figuring it out. I feel like I'm always doing that. So I appreciate you naming it that way. So when we first connected on Instagram, that was, I believe it was 2014, cause that's when I first made my account. And at the time I was looking for as much community as possible. I had kind of found a, you know, trans masculine, it seemed, community on Instagram. And I was like, let me connect with these people because I feel alone.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much everybody I found at first was white. And then I found you. And I also found that sort of, I think the account you're talking about is there was a thing called Melanated Trans Men.
It sounds familiar.
I think that was what it was called. There was another one. I'm going to think about it and it's going to come to me randomly in the conversation, but there was two accounts that did exactly what you talk about, which would spotlight specific trans accounts. Probably if you look back was like very heteronormative and like body standard type, but let's forget that for a second. I found your post about your top surgery and I think you were actually talking about like bruising and you had a difficult experience with that. But I remember just being like, wow, another Asian person. Like, this is so exciting. And so, you know, I feel like we didn't talk a ton, but we were always sort of in each other's orbits.
Yeah.
At least that's how I felt. Then you, like you said, you dropped out of school to go to do the L word. And it's funny because that was, I feel like there was a moment when there were ads for that role. I saw them everywhere. They were looking specifically for an Asian trans mask person.
Yeah.
I think even Alex Schmider might have sent it to me and probably to you as well. Yeah. It started actually before that when you were part of Miley Cyrus's Happy Hippie Foundation post. I don't know what campaign. I can't remember what exactly it was.
It was like a pride campaign in 2015, 2016. Yeah. I mean, also to back up even more. So you were saying that when you joined Instagram, you saw a lot of predominantly white trans men. And that's
right.
I was part of the very end of, I think, the tail end of the YouTube community. So I had joined YouTube originally.
Oh gosh.
And my videos are unfortunately still up because I don't have the email or password to take them down.
Oh gosh.
And
a relic, but, an artifact.
Unfortunately, I think my last video is from like 6 years ago. Huh. But that's what I found is the YouTube community was predominantly white trans men who were also very like muscular, which is primarily embarking on medical transitions.
Right.
And then
one-dimensional in many ways.
Yeah, very, very kind of common demographic, demographic with a lot of commonalities. And then I kind of pivoted toward Tumblr, and it still wasn't feeling like I was being able to carve out my voice, and then Instagram, and that's, you know, the snowball effect. But yes, through Instagram is where I got connected to the Happy Hippie Foundation. I think it was actually Twitter. And they were doing, this pride campaign, specifically around trans folks.
Right.
And they flew us out, my parents and I, my moms and I. And my first time in LA proper, we stayed like in Hollywood and, you know, we were doing all the touristy things, like looking at the stars in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Whereas now I'm like, I'm good. I don't need to see that. So we did that. And it kind of boosted my page a bit. And that led to being contacted by a casting department in New York. They were casting for this indie film called Adam, and they were looking for trans actors to play trans roles or characters.
A novel concept at the time.
Yeah, relatively, honestly. Like, it was, you know, it's only 2017. That's only 6 years ago. But like, but considering how quickly the landscape of casting, authentic casting and storytelling has changed in Hollywood, it was very relatively new. And but you know, after the campaign I changed my privacy settings, and so I didn't see the message for a while, and I thought I missed the opportunity. But I thought, you know, I'll ask, what is this about? You know, what's the film? Is this opportunity still available? And they're still looking for folks to audition. And so I sent a self-tape from Michigan thinking like, I'm never gonna get a movie role, like I'm literally about to start grad school. And then I did audition and I did a callback. They flew me to New York, and then as I was boarding the plane to come back to Michigan, all within like 24 hours, one of the producers called me and asked if I wanted to take the role. And so I deferred grad school for a year to do that, which only took 6 weeks, but I had to still do the whole year.
Right. Yeah.
And then that, you know, yeah, that, so the campaign really led to acting, and the first role led to the L Word for sure. Yeah.
I want to ask specifically about the Happy Hippie Foundation thing, because I have like a vague memory of that being like impactful on you in terms of, I can't remember what it was. Maybe you post about it. Maybe I heard about it. But I have a memory that might be wrong, so tell me that you, that was hard, that like afterwards there was a lot of attention on you, and then that was like,
yeah,
I can't remember.
You know, yeah, it was a very, I think, layered experience. On one hand, it's like, you know, you have this celebrity using her platform to boost trans voices and trans people of color as well. But you also kind of have to look at, you know, what does her other work look like? And there were experience, like examples of appropriation, and like, it doesn't really, you know, the good doesn't offset the problematic. And so I wasn't really sure how to reconcile that. I was not sure. I didn't know how to really hold many truths at that time. I was 19. But I had, you know, spent years doing, several years at that time, doing work around racial justice and community and advocacy. And so I think I just didn't have the tools to ask the questions I needed to ask myself before participating. I just sounded like a fun opportunity.
It makes sense. I think most people would probably just have been like, sure, yeah, Miley Cyrus, yeah, why not?
Sure. but, you know, I had some really valid critiques and criticisms of my participation, just like any other social justice work, because it's always room to grow and do better. And so it was, but it was very interesting too. Just like, yeah, my page kind of blew up a bit. I went from like a few thousand followers to like 40,000 followers over the course of like a week. Cause they were also rolling out our photos, one at a time.
Right.
And there was three photos, I think, of each group, basically each participant. So with every photo, I'd get more and more followers, and it definitely changed the way I looked at social media, and my relationship to Instagram in particular, because that's the platform I was on. But, it was, I think it was very formative, you know, it was very, very informative and formative.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that, I like what you said, where you said that people had valid criticism of you, and sounds like you were trying to sort of like hold those. And at the same time, I don't dismiss that. And it can be very heavy when you don't have the community, the skills, like you said, the space to really understand how to unpack those sort of criticism. And I think especially being part of a marginalized group, and then being, you know, asked to consider the impact of working with this one person, like, I think that can be a lot, especially when you're 19 and have not done it before. Like, it's like, where's the blueprint for how to walk through that?
Right. And I mean, you know, what's interesting is I think I also jumped a gun, because I was, before that, even what led to that was freshman year. I knew people on Instagram. I had friends who were doing internships, and I just knew people there, and they would think Instagram at that time was doing like artist of the week. They would, do you remember like early Instagram would put people in the explore page, and, and I, you know, also because one of the people I knew at Huffington Post had moved there and wanted to like find out a way for me to be able to use that platform. And what happened was it was something similar, where it was a really great opportunity, but like had a different effect than I thought it would have on me, which was like People Magazine wanted to post my thing. And I was like, oh, that sounds really cool. But they posted it before I got to even really give my answer, I think. And I was like, oh, I don't really love the way it's being framed. It was very, very focused on my medical transition, which makes sense because that's what I was posting about. But it was just early days, I think, of understanding the difference between, you know, centering our bodies as trans people versus who we are in the media, the broader message. And so it was both exciting, but also like slightly embarrassing, and not embarrassing, but kind of uncomfortable. And I learned from that too. You know, I think, I know I'm talking specifically about Instagram, and I have a very appreciative relationship toward it because of where I'm at now. But the early days of Instagram were so different, and the way that it was being used as an art form. And before the reels, before like stories, before boomerangs, you know.
You know, I think that Instagram has changed a lot. And at the same time, it also like hasn't. And the reason I say that is I think like in many, I always think that, shortest way to say it is this. I think that social media can be very painful for a lot of people. It can be very difficult. One of my guests has called it a drug, right? Because we're like, we're stuck to, you know, likes or whatever. And it can easily attach our worth to it. And it can be life-saving.
Yeah.
And I think both are true. And I think to me, it always ends up weighing more importantly towards that life-saving quality, because I I think probably because of personal experience and because I watched so many queer and trans people and other people of color as well, mm-hmm. other marginalized groups being able to connect and organize mm-hmm. really for the first time in the ways that they have not been able to do in the past through social media. So I think it's very powerful. And I mm-hmm. think if we don't learn as we go, like you're mm-hmm. talking about, it can be really, it can be a lot more painful.
Yeah. It depends on which side of it you're on too. Like, are you the creator or are you the audience?
Yeah.
And then how do you bridge those relationships and how do you kind of maintain boundaries that way? And are you someone who posts just like, do you have a private Instagram? You just post for your friends versus mm-hmm. again, like on a higher platform. And what does that mean with your relationship to it and yeah. your followers?
As I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking also about the, you know, the relationship with representation specifically. Mm-hmm. And I think we, you know, we could kind of dabbled in and out of what representation means. And I know something that you talk about a lot. I told you as you were coming in, sort of admitted to you, almost embarrassed. I am a little embarrassed actually, to be honest with you, that I don't watch a lot of TV, first of all. And I don't actually, I intentionally, this might surprise people, I intentionally don't watch TV that has trans characters in it. Mm-hmm. And that has kind of come slowly and then like been clear now. Like I mm-hmm. actively don't watch TV that I know that has trans people. So part of that is like, I don't watch the L Word. I didn't watch it. I watched it when I was a kid, when I was younger, not sure. a kid. In high school, I watched it.
Middle school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And had feelings about Max and representation mm-hmm. and what have you. But you know, I watched, for example, I watched The Fosters until they added a trans mm. character and oh, then really? I stopped watching it.
Okay.
I can so clearly see this one scene with Cole and he's like in an alleyway and the main character whose name I also forget.
Callie.
Okay. Thank you.
I think
you're right. Callie is like, anyways, the main character,
yes.
The girl is like, trying to get the Cole to come back and mm. and he's leaving, he's like getting testosterone off the streets and like
right.
And I was like, I'm not watching this.
Yeah.
Like I can't. And for me, you know, trans representation on TV has been mostly painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily because it's even all around trauma. Sometimes it is, but it's because it hasn't felt accurate for me.
Mm.
And I think I hesitate, like I was nervous to tell you this because I don't want you to think that I have any opinion about your role because I'm very grateful you're out there doing, mm-hmm. that you were doing your role. And I haven't watched it, so I can't tell you anything else about it.
Sure.
But I'm sure you did great. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that and your thoughts sure. on like, people, I can't tell you how many people will be like, Skylar, have you watched this show? Skylar, you have to have seen this show.
Yeah.
Skylar, like every freaking show that has a freaking trans character in it is Skylar, you should see this yeah. show. And I'm always like, no, thank you. I'm okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wanted to hear your thoughts.
You know, I think you bring up a really good point around like, even now there's not really a promise that trans representation will be progressive or not harmful. I think like one of the things that Disclosure showed us, a documentary, Netflix documentary, was that
yep.
Trans actors have been playing trans roles for a while.
Right.
Not always, duly credited or honored that way, acknowledged that way. But it shows that also that like even when there are trans people playing trans characters, again, there's no guarantee that that's going to be a positive representation.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's even used as like a token.
Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think like there's so many pieces to this conversation around like, is some representation better than none? And then like, what counts as good representation? And like, there's no obviously perfect one because you can't represent in many communities with one character.
Right, right.
So there's so many pieces to this, but I think that I don't blame you at all for not watching TV shows with trans characters because of many of those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like one of the things that Jen Richards says in the documentary that I always think of is that the ones that mess, like the messy representations, the messy projects wouldn't be as harmful if we had more to you know, more of a
broad range of experiences
yes,
to
thank
see.
You. Yeah. Yes. A collection.
Yeah.
So I think it's very challenging to then write a trans character because even if, again, as a trans writer, like
mm-hmm.
you're only writing from your experiences, you're trying to be authentic, but not like a spokesperson or mm-hmm. quote unquote preachy, and you want it to feel organic. There's so many different things to consider. And I think that there is definitely being like progress being made again,
sure.
like even just in the last few years since the breakdown for Adam came out, since Ian was on the OA, Ian Alexander was on the OA, mm-hmm. since Pose, mm-hmm. like we are seeing obviously more trans actors playing trans characters And does what's happening behind the camera? Are there more trans producers, more trans directors, writers, you know, crew members, sound, gaffers? Like, it really goes in all departments. It's not just about, as important as it is to visually or to have someone on the screen, it's not just about that.
Right.
And I think that's what, you know, organizations like Outfest are really trying to work towards, like GLAAD, like organizations that really try and push the needle forward in media, specifically television and film.
Right.
But I think, you know, again, the thing with the L word, Generation Q, is that my character started in 2019, was introduced in 2019. And even since then, things have changed so rapidly. So season one might be outdated already. And that's totally okay. That's just also because everyone has such different experiences. Language and the concept of identity is constantly changing, which makes it both beautiful and challenging in that way. Because whatever you make is going to be a relic. And it might not feel problematic, but it could be. And you have to accept that. And what does that mean for future stories? What does it mean for the future of products being greenlit? You know, are we bringing stories that gain quote unquote enough, because metrics are very subjective and viewership is very subjective, that prove these stories are wanted and needed? And I think there's obviously a proven want for it. It's more our what production companies, what streamers, what financiers are willing to take that risk, because even if it doesn't have the biggest audience in comparison to, like, I love Grey's Anatomy, but in comparison to Grey's Anatomy, you know, it still has a very specific audience. And so, and the folks who are watching it really need to see it. So I think there's so many different moving parts to it that I don't know if I can narrow down just like one thing that's great about it or one thing that should change about it. But I think that it's both very rapid, like the change is rapid, but also very slow. It's like it just feels like different areas are growing at different speeds.
Yeah. It's like I think that's what growth is, right? You can't measure it. And that's why we get growing pains when we grow, is because bones are growing faster than ligaments or what have you. So, I loved what you said, a line that I want to repeat. You said what you make will always be a relic. And I think that's so true. Everything we do is immediately becoming a relic, especially for you. You're on camera all the time. I think for me as a public figure, I feel watched as well, right? Like there's so many different ways in which we literally, everything we do becomes a relic. Every character we type, every character we play, everything we do online.
Every hashtag,
going back to your teacher, fear mongering you, but it is right. Everything becomes a relic, and I think one of the things I'm struck by is the grace that you have both towards yourself, it sounds like, and also towards the change of being able to adjust as you go. And you said something like it's going to become a relic, and it might be problematic. You just have to accept that. I think you're right, and I'm wondering how that feels to actually do that. You know what I mean? And like, I'll share like from my own experience. I always tell people I cannot possibly represent this community, right? And I can't represent Asian people. I can't represent Korean people. I can't represent trans, queer, whatever, any identity. I cannot represent that community. And yet I know that I am expected to do so. Yes. And that I like will represent in a situation, I will represent those people.
Just by virtue of existing.
Exactly. Like just by being there.
Yes, exactly.
And that's a pressure that I have to take the responsibility for. And it's a pressure I take the responsibility for, but not the name for, right? I'm not going to go out there and say I'm representing, but I take the responsibility for representing. I know you do the same. So talk to me about how that feels.
As you mentioned earlier, the breakdown called specifically for an Asian trans man. And I was like, oh, I'm an Asian trans man. I'm not in my 30s, but, you know, whatever. And after I got the role, throughout the process, one of the things about the show that I really appreciated was every season we would meet with the writers. And in season one in particular, they wanted to know who we were. And so I had a meeting with them, and it was like, you know, what makes you mad? What do you love? What do you do when you're angry at your mom? Like they wanted to get to know me to make the
character. Like therapy.
more or less, make the character feel as natural, I think, as authentic as possible. And one of the things I've talked about in the past was originally his job was being a scientist at JPL. And then they floated around the idea of him being a social worker. And I was like, oh my God, that's perfect. Like I'm studying social work. It's like not a secret that there are a lot of queer folks in social work because it is such a, because it is about social change and support.
I believe you're Your parents are also.
My mom's are social workers. They're clinical social workers. And I did fight it as long as I could. But the work I was doing in high school and college was essentially social work. So I was like, I might as well get a degree in it. Might as well make it official and like get paid what I should be getting paid, which is not a lot. But but I remember having a meeting at one point and going like, you know, okay, so I know he's a scientist right now, but like also as one of the few East Asian characters on the show, I would love maybe if he's not the only one in STEM. And the conversation was like our showrunner was like, oh, you know, I didn't even think about that. And so she was really receptive to that. And so became a social worker. But even something like that, something as seemingly innocuous as the career choice was how many times have we seen the East Asian scientist, STEM doctor, lawyer, professor, like
nerd, whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we got him to be an adjunct professor of social work. He's still in a professional career, but he's in a different field. But I could try and divorce that from him being queer, and I can try and divorce it from him being trans, but obviously I can't because, like I said, there are so many. I know a lot of queer trans men in particular in social work and queer folks in social work.
Mm. Not enough Asian ones, though.
That we know of. And so another piece of that conversation, though, continuously was, you know, who are we doing this show for? Who is Micah for? The showrunner would say, like, these are for, like, the little Leos, you know? And so in a way, kind of what you're saying around, I can't represent and I will not actively represent everybody. But if I'm going to be in this space, if I'm going to be, you know, occupying this position, this level of power, what can I do with it then to, like, support all of our communities in the best way I can? So it's a little bit of that. And it's also, you know, she would say, even though you don't represent everybody, there's some like person in middle America who like that's the first and only trans Asian man that they might see on screen. That's not to say I'm the only one who exists. Obviously, again, Ian Alexander, Chella Mann, D'Lo, like there's across Asian diaspora too, specifically. So it is definitely a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. And there's also, like you said, I think, like you mentioned about grace, like this need to grant myself grace, even though some others do it as well, but like make sure that I'm practicing that with myself. Like it's too much for one person, any one person to carry. Like no one person can or should be responsible for our communities. But again, if I'm going to be in these spaces, if I'm going to have this power, this platform, what can I do to advance our communities?
I like that. One of my new self mottos is I'm gonna do what I can do, and that is all I will do. And I mean that in the most literal sense of every single one of those words. I will do what I can do. That's it. No more, no less. And I think we try to stretch what we can do. I think other people try to stretch what we can do. I know I try to stretch what I can do all the time. Mm-hmm. But I actually want to come back to what can I actually feasibly do while maintaining my sanity, right? And my energy and my relationships and all that kind of stuff. And part of that is giving myself that grace that I can't do all the things that people expect of me, like represent everybody. But that kind of comes back to drawing that tension where like even though – like I think part – how to say this best, I'm not sure, but I think part of what I learned though is that even though I can't say that I'm going to represent everybody, I feel that it's irresponsible if I don't assume the responsibility of what it means to. And I think that's what you did in that moment where you said Micah shouldn't be a scientist, you know, because in that we're perpetuating this stereotype that you know all East Asians are in STEM. And I love that you caught that. I don't know if I would have. I think that, you know, I didn't even think about it when you said it. And then I was like, oh gosh, that's so important, you know? So I think I'm just really appreciating that sort of like line that you had to walk. And I'm curious if there was a time or times when you can remember not having that grace for yourself and how you navigated that.
Even when you kind of try to unlearn the individualism, we still are like, what can we do for ourselves? What can't we do for ourselves? Are we failures? Like this, like living under a capitalist society, like measuring our success. It's just like, it's so much pressure from various arenas of everyday life. And I think particularly because of this, of having a social platform, when do I give myself breaks from being online? And then therefore, like if I'm not online, I'm not boosting or sharing different pages and things like that, but I'm also taking care of myself. But like, it's a constant kind of like, what's the balance of I can't take help. I can't support others if I can't support myself necessarily. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty continual struggle. And I think, like, you know, I was actually just talking about this in therapy of like, when you have a privilege that you feel guilty about, right? Like, being a non-Black person, a trans person of color specifically, being lighter, fairer skin, like access to white spaces, being a binary trans man, like more often read as cis, probably more likely read as straight. How am I occupying spaces like that and using my platform with these identities that are more invisible? But also still knowing that, like, they are identities. Like, I am still not white and I'm still not cis and I am not straight. But that's, I think that's just involved in any sort of identity work and advocacy. And, you know, you have to sit with that discomfort of that guilt and that, but like you said, you do what you can when you can do it. Coming from the world of social work to Hollywood was also a big, I think, eye opener too, because
Very different worlds.
Very different. The minute you make it political, to make it, you know, quote unquote, make it political, even though art is inherently political because there's always a message to me. It really changes your standing. I think there are times that I've wanted to say things in a room with like CEOs and network execs and I haven't. And I feel guilty for not doing that. And also giving myself grace, like, this is my first big role. Like, how much power do I really have to say something? Does it make a difference? Am I putting my like ability to make a living also in jeopardy? And like definitely having to ask those questions and make those compromises and living with those. And, you know, I will always plug her book, but Michelle Kim, The Wake Up, the Know Your Why, and how are you living in alignment with your values? And constantly asking myself that and just knowing that there will inevitably be times you have to compromise for, whether it's for like literal survival, whether it's for financial stability, like for career wise and
energy
capacity. Yes, exactly. And guilt doesn't help anybody, you know? So finding ways to let it pass through you, hold it. And then how can you refuel yourself to then put energy into the areas that need to be attended to?
One of the things I've recently been learning about, and I promise this is relevant, let me get there, is that you mentioned Michelle Kim's Wake Up. Everybody should read that
book.
And there's another book that I recently began reading. I'm not done with it, but it's good. I can recommend it.
Please do.
It's called Minor Feelings.
Oh, yes. I read that.
Okay, cool.
Loved it.
Kathy Park Hong. In her book, she's talking a lot about what she deems minor feelings. And it really speaks to the Asian American experience in many ways. But what I was thinking about, well, first I'll quickly explain what that means. A lot of times because of the model minority myth that East Asians specifically, but Asian Americans sort of more generally, are this quote model minority and that therefore we actually don't experience oppression. And it really gaslights a lot of people into believing that they aren't experiencing oppression when they are. And there's a lot more complexity that we're not, this, you know, this episode is not just about that. So, if you are curious as a listener, please go research the model minority. But when I was listening to this book, and I have more to go, but one of the primary things that kept coming up for me was actually also about trans masculine folks and trans masculine individuals, because in many ways, there's, you said you are red as cis, you're red as straight. I am also red as cis. I'm also red as straight, neither of which I am. Sometimes even red as like white, which is really weird when that happens. It's very rare. Happens every once in a while, and I think people just might see me from the wrong angle because I very much am perceived most of the time as not white. But in any case, we're perceived in these dominant identities, these sort of identities that are generally accepted by society, whereas our trans and queerness might not be. And there's a minorness to that. There's a erasure to that. And I've been talking to some trans femme folks who are friends of mine, and there's a hyper visibility there, and there's then a hyper erasure for us. And if we add Asian Americanness onto it, that only increases that lack of visibility. And I'm not trying to compare either of these, that neither are particularly good.
No.
But I want to make space for that in this conversation because to me,
Yeah,
go ahead.
Totally. Well, one of the things that I thought of when you were talking about that is there is a continual kind of comparison between the media that represents trans women and trans femmes versus the media that represents trans men. And I think you see a lot, unfortunately, I've seen a lot of trans men, particularly white trans men, kind of say like, well, where's our representation? And like, you know, there's Pose, what about us? And I think that's a really dangerous phrasing and dangerous perspective of, like you said, there's there's that visibility, but then it becomes hyper visibility that also comes with risk and safety and danger. And so I think it's less about, well, where's ours, and more like, where can we continue to tell our stories in a way that they will be received the way we want them to be received? And I think it's very, very dangerous to position like trans women, trans femmes versus trans masc, trans men,
absolutely,
which is happening too much for
right,
sure.
Right, right.
And I think that it can, that can exist with also feeling like our experiences aren't told in the same way mm-hmm. and in the same arena. And I think that like those exist together, but they don't have to be these contrasting, like, why does representation have to come at the, you know, expense of the other? I don't, that's kind of how the business will see it, the industry, Hollywood industry, but I don't think it helps anyone to continue that like narrative.
Well, I think there's a hope for the world that I see, which is why I wanted to point out, I don't want to contrast them or compare them, is because I want to live in a world where there's room for both. And and I think there is room for visibility for all of us. And I think it speaks to the systems of oppression that cause the same types of problems. Like, it's the same system that's causing mostly Black trans femmes to be hyper visible. That's also erasing, you know, trans masculine Asian men.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
it's the same.
Of course.
These
of
are the same problems that just, or the, sorry, different problems that are coming from the exact same source.
Yes. And I wasn't necessarily, just want to clarify, I wasn't saying that like you were making, but I think also what that speaks to in a way is, I think when we were, I did a panel for Disclosure for like this Australian Film Festival. And I don't remember how I phrased it exactly at the time, but I think that when you're talking about the system of like the stories and where like the industry in particular, you know, which is predominantly run by white cis straight men, what we've seen is there, and what we've seen online is this phrasing of trauma porn. Right. They know that trauma porn sells. They know that stories of oppression and violence against minority groups, marginalized communities, sells, that white audiences are going to see them in droves and give them that money. And like, whereas people in those communities are like, can you please stop telling these horrifically violent stories? And so when I think about when you say like the system that allows this, it's that, because trans men do are also victims of violence, but at, not at quite at the same rates or in the same circumstances, right? And so therefore you hear more about these stories in the news of trans women, particularly trans women of color, and that's what sells on screen, unfortunately. I think because also if you're read as a cis man, like you said, you have these privileges, these identities that let you kind of blend into the dominant structure. And when you bring in race and ability and all these other identities, obviously just plays out differently. But I, you know, what you're saying about being an East Asian trans man too, this double layer of like invisibility in a sense, or just not being seen. For sure. Again, another thing I talked about with my therapist, this week was basically like, how do I see myself and in what spaces? And I see, you know, for me, I'm also an adoptee. So like I feel in my experiences kind of erased as Asian, erased in some spaces, or see, or like have my experiences kind of immediately not considered because I do am perceived as cis, which makes sense. I mean, I do think that makes sense depending on the space you're in, where you share those parts of yourself, right? But also like, you know, how do I reconcile and navigate what it means to be an East Asian adoptee trans man? Like never feeling Asian enough for a long time, not feeling queer enough, whatever that meant. I've never had an issue of feeling man enough, honestly, just because I think partly because I grew up with two moms who I got to learn. I didn't learn the through any quote unquote absence of masculinity or masculine role models. In fact, I like was very drawn to like maternal figures, like my moms, and I was more comfortable around like women. And I think men and masculinity was something I didn't have a fear of. It's not something I was uncomfortable around. It's just something I observed in a very different way. It felt more intentional, like because it didn't feel like it was missing. It was just something like, oh, this exists too. And it's not necessarily the opposite of femininity. It's just at the same time. So like that, my manliness, quote unquote, was pretty secure for a long, for most of my life. It's more like queer enough, sometimes trans enough, and then
I feel
Asian
that.
Enough, you know? So I don't know if that really, we moved a bit away from the original question, but I think a lot of those things just meld together in this like feeling of how do we share our experiences? And again, not at the expense or like at any sort of sacrifice or scapegoating of trans women's experiences.
Right, right. You mentioned being an adoptee, and in my life, I also as far as I know, you're a transracial adoptee. Meaning mm-hmm. that your parents are not the same race as you.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody who doesn't know, transracial does not mean changing your race or saying you are mm-hmm. a black woman when you are not. We're not going to get into that. But I have said, I have like talked about transracial yeah. adoptees, and so many times people think that I mean that person, and I'm like, please no. Absolutely
please no.
not.
Okay, please no. Anyways. She gave every transracial adoptee like,
oh my God, that was the biggest so horrible. Headache. Okay. Anywho, so transracial means you've been adopted. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it means that you've been adopted. You're a person of color who's been adopted by a white family.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, because there's sometimes yep. you know, yep. the opposite happens, but incredibly rarely.
Okay.
So the reason I'm focusing on that is because I have found in my life that a lot. So I'm half Asian. My mom is Korean and my dad is white. And I've also always felt not Asian enough. And it's been interesting because I found a lot of resonance with transracial adoptees, mm-hmm. Especially those who are also East Asian, because there's yeah. a similarity of experience yeah. in many ways. And one of my best friends is also a transracial adoptee. He's mm. he's Korean and he's adopted by a white Jewish family. Mm. Very like different, similar in many ways as well. The reason I name that is because for me, the not enoughness began with race.
Mm.
It didn't begin with queerness. It didn't begin with transness. It actually, I can't think of anything else it began with except for race.
Totally.
Because from the very earliest time I can remember, I don't remember a single identity except being Asian American / being mm-hmm. mixed race. And being mixed race mm. was the biggest part of every identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned early on how to define my racial identity on my own as opposed mm-hmm. to with other people. And that was like a really empowering, I think, part of my childhood, because I figured out how to do that. And I would love to hear about your journey learning your Asian-ness, but I want to ask you from this sort of like circle lens. So mm-hmm, hold on. Because mm-hmm. one of the things I remember a couple of years ago, there was the shooting in Atlanta mm-hmm. of mostly Asian women.
Mm-hmm.
I have family that lives in Atlanta, mm-hmm. Not that far from where the shooting happened. They are my Korean family, and the people who were killed were Korean women.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was like very deep for me. And I remember you wrote this post about it, and it basically said, I think you were, I don't, do you remember the post exactly?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the post?
I don't remember word for word, but it was a bit of a thought vomit. It was kind of a process, like in real time processing, because so the news was trickling. What I remember of it was the news was, you know, pieces were trickling out. It was like, all we knew at one point in the beginning was East Asian women were shot. I didn't know that they were primarily Korean.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first thought as an adoptee, and I know I wasn't the only one because I saw this in a lot of adoptee discussion boards, was like, oh my God, is there a world where that could have been my birth mother?
Mm.
And that is something like, even if it doesn't make any logical sense, even if it's not like, you know, there's millions and millions of East Asian women and then millions and millions of like sub, you know, ethnic communities, what are the chances it would be my birth mother? But that's just like a thought that came into my head that was hard to shake. And I shared something about that. And I got into it with some folks who, I don't know if they're trolls. I don't know if they like genuinely believe these things, but very frustrating around adoption. And like, you know, did I ever consider what my adoptive parents would think about that post and like about hurting them? And I did have hard conversations with my moms around that time too, because I was like suddenly just really struggling to be around white people. Because it was on like the eve of St. Patrick's Day, and I came to work and everybody was like, it's St. Patrick's Day. And I'm like, literally one of the worst days.
For it to be St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah. Jeez.
Oh God.
So it was a very challenging, complicated, awful few weeks after that.
Yeah.
I
cried harder than I have, I think,
mm-hmm.
any tragedy, honestly, including tragedies about trans people. Like,
same.
I cry a lot, just to be frank.
Love it.
I cry a lot especially when I read the freaking news. Like, I'm always crying. But this one, I was mm-hmm. alone in my apartment. My partner wasn't there. She was on a trip, so it was just me. And actually, the apartment was completely empty as well because we were moving.
Okay.
So it's just like the picture, right? It's got an empty room. The only thing that's there is a carpet. And I was like sitting on the floor reading your post, bawling. Like, I just started bawling and feeling emotional now too, because I think one of the things you mentioned, and I don't remember verbatim either, but one of the things you said was something like, I want to give my other, you know, people who don't feel Asian enough permission. It was something about permission. Maybe it wasn't that post or something.
I know that post though. It was, I think, from another adoptee.
Okay. Okay. You had maybe reposted it then. Yeah, I read something about saying like, you don't need, let's not, you know, we're watching this tragedy. Mm-hmm. We don't need to decide who's Asian enough. And up until that point, I had been crying, but I hadn't been crying, like I hadn't been consciously crying for myself yet, if that makes sense. I had been crying because it was a tragedy. And then I started bawling like even more. And it was because I was like, oh my God, but like, what about like my family? And when I say that, I want to include you as well. Like it's all of us in this sort of like expansive Asian diaspora, whatever that means, whether that means you're connected to the blood that you came from or not. And there was so much there. And I immediately called texted my friend, my best friend who's adopted as well. And I was like, hey, I'm here. I'm seeing you, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but it just, it felt so heavy, you know?
Same. I mean, our house was having dinner. We were having dinner as a group and I saw the headline in between checking my phone and I just shut down and I couldn't say in the moment like, oh my God, there've been this shooting. Mm-hmm. Because also we're living in a time where there are constantly
massive
acts of violence. And so it's like, why is this one the one that makes me want to sob? And I did that night of the shooting. I was in my room sobbing and I asked my best friend, I was like, one of my roommates, I was like, can you come in here? Because and all I could think was like, it could have been my birth mom. And like, you just spiral. I was spiraling. I was like, oh my God, could have been my birth mom. And it was, another reason I thought it was someone who was Chinese was like, it was a massage parlor. And I didn't have any other broader context at the time. I didn't know that sometimes there's like a relationship to sex work too. And like different, like, you know, Asian communities have massage parlors. Part of not being as connected to community also means there's a lot that I don't know.
Sure.
And so, but just my thoughts were spinning like, oh my God, I'll never get to meet her. Like, oh my God, it's just like terrible. And it's just like, you know, definitely some selfishness in that, but also like just grief around like, I don't know how deep we want to get into this, but I do think, and I think that like a lot of the anti-Asian violence in the wake of COVID really has woken, like we talked about the model minority myth, woken a lot of particularly East Asian folks, because also let's be real, South Asian folks have been encountering violence for decades.
Sure, sure, sure.
If not centuries, by the US. But that we, across generations, many people were realizing like, even though we knew we weren't white, we were like, oh, white, like realizing, and I say we, because even though I felt like I was pretty aware of it, there was something still clicked. Mm-hmm. Like there's safety because we're not dark. Mm-hmm. You know, those of us who are fair East Asian folks or don't have darker skin. Mm-hmm. And also like being Asian still doesn't protect us from violence at all. Mm-hmm. It just means that like there are levels of violence that we may experience and may not experience. Mm-hmm. And I think what was simultaneously unfortunate was while people were realizing that, it kind of increased the colorism and anti-blackness and racial triangulation and kind of like linear violence that we're seeing now, which is a whole other topic. But
yes, and it's an important one that we probably can't get into today.
No, we don't have time for that.
But I think I think you're spot on. I saw a lot of anti-blackness happening during that time as well. And a lot, I mean, that's the, you know, those are the tools of oppression is to pit the oppressed against each other. And bingo, we got destruction. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about that partially because I remember that post, you know, and I so appreciated how you were sharing your experience at the time. And I also think about, you know, we're talking about representation and that was such a central part. Like what representation do we get? And then that was the biggest story about Asian women that year. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think, you know, there's this, going back to the model minority myth and the sort of minor feelings from that book that I mentioned. I think through COVID, there was a sort of a surgence of caring about Asian Americans to a degree and saying, oh, wait, this is a problem too, right? That was the first time I've ever been asked about experiencing racism directly. I had never been asked. I've been doing this work for years and more than 5 years before the pandemic hit. And I had never been asked about experiencing racism before. I'd been asked, you know, what did your Asian grandmother think? Which was really just racism. That's a microaggression too, right?
Yeah.
What about your Asian family? Yeah. Asians are conservative, right? I'd gotten that question repeatedly, but I had never been asked what was experiencing racism like. And the first time I got asked it, it was in some panel during the pandemic. I'm sitting at home in my apartment, of course. And I actually didn't know how to answer it because I was like, well, I'm not black. I'm not dark skinned. I don't know how to answer it. So I said something about the model minority myth that I had learned years ago and kind of parroted that. And then after the panel ended, I went and did all this research on model minority myth.
Mm-hmm.
And I started sort of piecing apart my childhood and piecing apart even now how mm-hmm. I'm perceived. I started thinking about how differently I've been received in the world as an Asian woman or what people thought was an Asian woman.
Yes.
And now as what people see as an Asian man and how mm-hmm. different that is too.
Yeah. Totally.
And I just like, and there was so much there. Right.
So much.
I was curious if you've had a similar experience with like coming into your Asianness.
Oh my God. I actually really, I really appreciate that you mentioned like the differences in being perceived as an Asian woman versus being perceived as an Asian man.
Very different.
Because I transitioned so young. I began my transition quite young. I was 12. But for those years before that, I was predominantly masculine presenting. I was the tomboy. I was all the kids. Like that Mulan was the only way my friends knew how to like understand like I was just a tomboy. And so like I never really quote lived as a woman or lived as in a world that perceived as a woman. I lived perceived as a girl, like an Asian girl, and particularly as an adoptee. Actually, I used to be afraid that when I'd say I was an adoptee, that would inadvertently out me because so many of the adoptees from China were girl babies assigned female at birth or girls.
I see. Yeah. Yeah.
Not all, obviously, but so many.
Right.
And so there's definitely like that piece. So most of the time now I'm just like, yeah, I'm an adoptee. And like, I'm also out as being trans. So like,
that is known.
Yeah. I was not always perceived as a boy, right? Mm-hmm. So I lived as a girl who was perceived as a tomboy.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think when I look back, I don't know if it's just because it's what I know now, but like I think about the ways I internalized femininity, what does it mean to be like the way the messages I learned about like quote unquote subservience, particularly when it comes to Asian women.
Mm-hmm.
Care, you know, the emotional labor that women in general have to carry, particularly women of color. And I can see ways where that was around in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I can also see the ways that it hadn't quite gotten its full like hooks in me because I was so fervent in my identity as a masculine person.
That's so beautiful that you had that confidence in yourself. I love that.
I will say though, like it's not for lack of, I grew up with two moms and my mom who adopted me in China had a partner at the time who second parent adopted me in Texas and they split when I was five. And that parent was incredibly, incredibly fierce in her desire of me not wearing boys' clothes, exhibiting any masculine behavior.
As a queer person, that's fascinating.
The ironic thing is too, she taught queer studies at the local college.
Wow.
But it's, she was also a different generation, and right. I think that's anywhere near an excuse, but I think it was just a very different understanding of gender and gender fluidity.
Right.
But so like, even though my moms, when I would go to their house, they nurtured my masculine exploration and like experience. And so I think that's partly why I did have that confidence. But not for lack of it trying to be broken down and sometimes definitely bulldozed over with like having to wear certain shirts and piercing my ears and I'm growing my hair out. And, you know, this parent didn't even want me to wear the white socks with gray feet because they're boy socks.
What?
It was incredibly, it was very mixed messages. And, I think in retrospect, I can see the ways I was resisting that, but also the ways as a parent and a child relationship, you give into it because you have no choice. So it was a very bizarre dichotomy of allowance.
I think I love these conversations about gender and how we walk through it. I mean, they're painful sometimes too, but I think it's so interesting to consider the different lenses we've walked through the world with. And before my transition, I also had parents that let me wear my clothes the way I wanted to for the most part, except for very unique occasions, which were also very confusing. Going to a piano recital, going to a fancy event, going to a dinner, whatever, I had to wear a dress.
In public and like...
Exactly.
Spotlighty,
exactly. And I would resist it like nobody's business. But every other time I would wear normal, what I considered my normal dress, which was mostly boys' clothes.
Sure.
And that was fine. Nobody had an issue with that. Well, that's not true. My parents didn't have an issue with that. My classmates did, but my
external worlds.
Exactly. And yet in high school, I went through this phase where I tried to be this girl, right? That everybody wanted me to be. And the way I was treated then was very hyper... I guess fetishized is the shortest way to say it, right? It's fetishized. And there was a guy on my team who only wanted to date Asian girls. And like, I only found that out after he'd been pursuing me for a long time. And I was absolutely not interested. I also just not particularly interested in men anyways. But right. at the time, I didn't know what to do. And then later, one of my teammates was like, oh, yeah, he always goes after the Asian girls. And I was like, gross. No.
Is it better or worse to know that?
I think it was worse.
Yeah.
I didn't need to know because I wasn't going to pursue him anyways.
Right. But
anyways, that like there was this, I felt very sexualized in high school. And it was, I was on a swim team with these guys too. And we were like, I mean, basically naked in swimsuits all the time. And I had a lot of comments about my body. I was, you know, I was told that my body was talked about a lot in the men's locker room. Really gross stuff, right?
It's just so young.
But then we flip it. And now I'm over here being perceived as an Asian man. And there's actually like interesting data research that shows that Asian men are actually lowest on the hierarchy of like selected things on dating apps. So there's like, if you look at the, because dating apps and the internet, we can actually now measure who is, you know, gets the most likes, gets the most swipes, gets the most matches, whatever. Of course, on top is white men over anybody else. Yes, of course. And then white women are up there as well. I think black men are actually somewhere up there, but because they're fetishized, of course. And then the bottom is, or the least liked, the least matched with, what have you, is black women and Asian men. And I just thought that was like, I didn't know that. And then somebody told me that recently. It was like a couple years ago. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's like, that maps onto my experience so well. Oh, Asian women are also at the top. Sorry. Asian women are like black men are fetishized. So they're up near. I think the two top demographics are, white men and Asian women.
Okay.
And then underneath there is black men. Somewhere in the between is brown people.
Yeah.
And then the bottom, right, is Asian men and black women. And it all makes sense if you look at white supremacy, of course, right? The fetishization of and hyper submissive nature that's assigned to Asian women. So that is why they're up there on the sort of being considered attractive. And then Asian men, where you assign femininity and submissiveness to Asian men, we're put down there. I don't know if this question's gonna make any sense, but I'm curious, A, what you think about that, and B, how that's affected how you've also represented your role like in TV and like what it means to be considered attractive. Cause you know, like all that, anyways.
Yeah. Well, I think what's unfortunate about that data is then it kind of fuels, I think what we see too often also is like at the end of the day, East Asian cis men are also cis men and both victims and participants of white supremacy and patriarchy. And so we see a lot of white men feeling like they're owed dates, first of all, or Asian men, excuse me, because they're by virtue of being men, and also like jealousy of being chosen, not being chosen, and as if they deserve attention from women, which is like,
which nobody does.
Nobody deserves it, you know? And it's like the frustration is, it's just a fact, you know, data is the fact. And when you consider all the systems and institutions that lead to that reasoning, it's really unfortunate. I think that like, you know, what we consider to be attractive, there's a whole debate about preference and all that. And it's like, yes, people have their preferences. And at the same time, you can still acknowledge where they come from and what often is originates from like implicit messaging and explicit messaging throughout our entire lives.
Yeah. I think people miss that. I want to pull that out just to make sure that we really hear that, which is that, yes, people have preferences, but they didn't come out of nowhere.
Right.
They didn't just, you don't birth with these preferences that just existed. I mean, maybe some things like you like this food or that, but even that, there's actually really great research that supports that if you don't have a certain food until a certain age, you won't like it ever. Right? If you don't eat sushi before the age of 30, chances are you will never eat it.
No way.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's, and if you only eat broccoli by a certain age, you will never eat it. If you don't, food is, anyways, my point is preference is often taught, whether explicitly, which people remember, or implicitly where they don't remember.
Yes.
But I think that that's something, especially, we're not going to get into this, but with like dating trans people and like, is it transphobic not to date trans people? Like preferences are not just preferences when we live in a world riddled with oppression.
Right. And preferences as a standalone thing and are not inherently evil or bad.
Sure.
They just are. And then, but again, yes, like you said, like how do you kind of dig deeper into the understanding of why you have those preferences, where they came from. And then you asked me, how do I kind of think about that in the work as presenting?
Yeah, well, if you consider that I'm going to make some big generalizations.
Yes, please.
That they're not necessarily
true. We can zoom out and zoom in.
Yeah. So the generalization is that, you know, if you're on TV, you're famous. If you're famous and a celebrity, you're seen as attractive or whatever you're considered that way. And then, but also you're an Asian man and you're a trans man.
Yeah.
And how do those interact? Right.
I mean, this is something I've been struggling with for a long time, actually, is like this idea of what's considered attractive and like coming to terms with the fact that in some ways I do adhere to like certain beauty standards. Mm-hmm, like people like to comment on my jawline and it's like, yeah, flattering, but it's like it speaks to this larger, again, preference or like hierarchy of features that are given more value. Mm-hmm. I'm thinner. I'm like average semi-athletic body type. I'm not disabled. Again, I have lighter skin tone, even for like, I think Southern East Asian, like, or East Chinese, I should say, excuse me. There are all these things that make sense when I zoom out and try and kind of out of my body experience, like look at it. But then like living in the world, I'm like, it's weird to be perceived and like have, like, sure, they feel nice when you post something and people are like, you know, leaving very flattering compliments, but it doesn't mean I believe it. I think I'm not impervious to the messaging of body standards and heteronormativity and cisnormativity. I think I, in the last few years, as I've gotten to really settle into my queerness or begun to settle in my queerness, things like mannerisms and the way I physically carry myself, I spent so long, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, really trying to just like hone in on masculinity at the expense of not being showing any femininity, and then realizing, oh, that doesn't have, like, they exist together. It's not one or the other. Everything exists together. Everything everywhere all at once. You know, like they don't exist. Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive. They're not isolated from one another. And so getting comfortable with being more like gestury and like whatever the word is.
Flamboyant is a word that I would assign to
experimenting with colors and kind of just like, you know, and these sound like such like low stakes things, and for some they are, and then for some, when you have multiple identities and you've lived and you're perceived in a certain way, they are not, you know. So with Micah in particular, I the only ways that I was ever kind of like slightly self-conscious or like, oh my gosh, am I doing this, are all of these things aligning, my views of masculinity, femininity, you know, queerness, whatever, fluidity, is through his hair and his dress. And I think every year was a very different style. And I kind of love that because I also was learning my own style as I moved out of Michigan, as I lived in LA, as I kind of became an actor in LA. Like, what is my style as an individual? What's Micah? And the last year I felt incredibly comfortable as Micah through my, like, through wearing accessories, rings, earrings, bracelets, necklaces, through having more color, through like really just playing around with particularly fashion. But it is, again, not isolated from all the identities I eventually bring to the screen. This was the first year we had Asian hair department, like the head of the hair department and the woman who did my hair are both Filipino. And it was the best experience. I mean, that's not to say I have, you know, the rest were awful. It's just like you can tell when someone knows the texture of your hair, as we have seen from Black actresses talking about, like, not like having to either do their own hair, bring people in on their own, just how under prioritized it is. So I don't think I have a clear answer to that. I think it's because I'm constantly learning, because also, again, I'm also 26. Like, in the grand scheme of life, there's so much more to live in terms of getting comfortable with my body, learning what my body, my relationship with my body should be or what I want it to be. Like, when I first started tea, when I first, you know, was getting my prescription for tea, I wanted to look like Taylor Lautner from Twilight. That was my body goal.
I think a lot of people did.
You know, like, and so, but both personally and I think societally, even though many things are the same around Eurocentric body standards, one of the ways social media has helped is highlighting all body types. Every different type of body that we can show has really been very, very meaningful and very impactful.
I think that kind of plays into one of the things you said earlier, which is the concept that, you know, the negative or the non-accurate or the potentially harmful representations of trans people would be okay or would be less harmful if there was more. And I think that's something that people don't understand, because, like, it's not that the stories about trauma are unnecessary, because I think for some people they are really necessary. And I think they are some people's truths. And just because we can't expand them or extrapolate to them to everybody doesn't mean we shouldn't have the stories. It just means that when those are the only stories, like that's the problem. And I think kind of that concept of scarcity of representation is that's the problem. The problem yes. isn't, I mean, there are problematic representations, but a generalization, yeah. I think, is that it's not any one representation that's the problem. It's not any one trans person, any one mm-hmm. trans role, any one trans writer. I think it's the collective issue that there isn't enough so that mm-hmm. there's a whole ocean. There's like a few drops. And then if those don't work, they don't work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I would love to see you play I don't mean random as in not important. I mean random as in not necessarily about transness mm. role where like your character can still be trans. You should, I would love it to
sure.
be trans. But then for it just, you to just be like, that would mm-hmm. be so cool. I'm waiting for that show.
Yeah.
I've seen people dabble into it. You know, I'll take back my earlier statement. I have watched one show where there happens to be a trans person, but it's for one episode. And there's like a scene where the person, what show was it called? It's the one about the lawyer.
Oh,
in LA.
All Rise?
Yes, All Rise.
Yes.
Which I loved.
I thought it was, they had a trans person. Oh, was that?
No, it's for one episode. And I don't know if it was one episode. It was like for 10 minutes, but this person comes in and they're a tortured youth. And one of the lawyers is defending this person and the lawyer's respectful to the person, but the person is like, they're a they or something like that.
Where it's not like in this like comedic, like overdone.
Yeah. It was just kind of slotted in there, but I want sure. more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I want you to play like some Asian American dude, maybe an adoptee mm-hmm. who's living his life and happens to be trans. Like I want that. Yeah.
And I want, you know, for that to happen, I think what has to happen in the industry is it doesn't have to be one or the other. Cause I think what mm-hmm. we're seeing is like a very valid and important focus also on like non-binary,
sure.
like androgynous, like gender fluid voices.
Right.
And let's please.
Yeah.
It's the unfortunate part is that comes like, okay, now that we've done cis or like binary trans voices, let's yeah. do, you know, that's
how happening in chapters.
Yes. The industry focuses on one group at a time mm-hmm. instead of realizing these all exist together, especially when you think about like it being a literal LGBTQ community.
Right. Right.
And they haven't quite figured out a formula for all of us to exist in the same place at the same time on different networks. You know, right, Queer as Folk got canceled. We are now over. We had mm-hmm. three great years. We had that's a pretty decent run for a reboot,
mm-hmm.
but so many, you know, shows on Netflix are canceling. They're like primarily like queer women shows. So it's, and you still will have like the one-off queer best friend, primarily a gay guy mm-hmm, in a mm-hmm. show. But yeah, I think that's hopefully it will show that we can have many shows. I mean, like yeah. how many superhero shows are on right now? How many doctor shows? How many lawyer shows? How many police shows are on?
Yeah.
But you can only have one or two queer shows at a time.
Right, right.
And even
right.
then it's like queer women, queer men.
Right, right. Yeah, mostly cis.
Yeah.
All right, so to wrap up, yeah. I agree with all the things you're saying, and I do want to give you back your mm-hmm. time because otherwise we're gonna be here forever. We'll
literally be here forever, yeah.
Which would be lovely, but
I mean,
but we need to end the episode mm-hmm. at some point. my question for you to end: you had said that when you were creating Micah, or when the writers were creating Micah, and you were mm-hmm. in that process, sort of negotiation of who Micah is going to be, if you mm-hmm. will. You said that it was about sort of like speaking to the little Leos
mm.
in the world. So if you could directly speak to those little Leos, what would you say now?
I think if I could talk to me, little Leo me, I would just try and convince him that like every awful thing that happens, I don't want to say it's for a reason because that feels too like, I feels too like, therefore you have to be okay with it, but like it leads to something, and that I wish I could change things, but I would also be afraid that I wouldn't end up here. So I would say to reach out to the friends you have, trust that you will still be loved and supported, and that there is a future for you despite everyone's efforts to try and take it away.
I think that is expandable to all the other Leos, all the other trans people, all the other mm-hmm. people who don't feel like that they quite fit in, transracial adoptees, mixed race kids, anyone. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm going to repeat your line. You said, there is a future for you no matter how much people try to take it away.
Mm-hmm.
Leo, thank you. We are living in the future. We are living yeah. here with you here, with me here so many times. I think I never imagined my own future, and here we are living in it. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was great. I wish I got to ask you more questions and you get to like be in the hot seat.
Well, maybe we'll do that sometime too.
I'm so glad that Leo and I got to have this wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Leo, for your time, your generosity, and your compassion over the years. Let's get to the episode's question. What is good representation? In addition to actually being in the conversation while we had it, I've also listened to this episode a few times trying to call a good final answer to what is good representation. And I really don't have a specific thing, but I think that's kind of the key. Representation never can be complete. Representation can never be comprehensive, and representation is always evolving, right? As soon as we make something, it is immediately a relic, something that is of the past. And I think representation is always just a few steps behind, sometimes a lot of steps behind, right? But the goal of representation is to follow as closely behind people and evolution as possible. I think that good representation knows that there is no such thing as perfect representation. And as Leo said, good representation understands that it's going to miss the mark. And maybe most importantly, good representation understands that we always need more representation, especially of marginalized identities. We hope that our first season of Dear Skylar has brought you some of this good representation. I hope you found resonance or excitement, some piece of wisdom. I hope maybe something made you a little uncomfortable and let you push the edges of your comfort zone to learn something new. I know that I and the team have had a lot of fun bringing you these episodes. A huge thanks to all the people who made this possible, particularly my producer, Antonio Enriquez, and of course, to you all listeners here right now. Stay tuned for season 2. We're making a few really exciting changes to the format of the show, so I hope you come back in a couple months. We'll see you then.